So an ideal is, so when we talk about the Bodhisattva ideal, I just wanted to talk about ideals in Buddhism in particular. And Buddhism, well, I'll just kind of start from the beginning, but Buddhism is about transforming your consciousness, you know? Buddhism's about becoming more than you are currently by changing what is in your mind, the flavors of your mind, you could say. By moving them away from craving, hatred, and delusion or lack of mindfulness, and towards kindness, care, presence, mindfulness, awareness, and spiritual wisdom. So that's the basic ideal in Buddhism. The Bodhisattva ideal is just one particular manifestation within Buddhism, and it's usually contrasted against what would be called the Arhat ideal. There's a really good talk on Free Buddhist Audio by Sangharakshita, the founder of our movement, on the difference between the Arhant ideal and the Bodhisattva ideal. But historically, what happened in India was that the people were practicing Buddhism, but they were practicing with a sort of with a tendency to see the practice as something that you achieve as an individual. Yeah, so it's something that you are accomplishing. And so you're gaining enlightenment, you know? And in order to gain enlightenment, you don't need other people. You just kind of work on your own mind. You kind of, you know, you move away from craving, hatred, and delusion. You move towards kindness, you know, kindness, generosity, and mindfulness, and you become enlightened. But of course, it's really kind of a false goal because you can't really practice kindness or generosity outside of other people. Yeah, you will have other people that you're needing to practice that towards. But nonetheless, there was this movement towards the single practitioner, and even to this, you know, even into the kind of the last 20 years. It's frequently a slight of Buddhism that Buddhism's thought of as individualistic, you know? And it's selfish even. Some people even would say that Buddhism can be selfish. Now, once again, I don't think that's true, but it's a possible misinterpretation of what the practice is. So at this time in India, there was a group of people who said, well, wait a second. All the teachings that we had from the Buddha, from the Pali Canon, which, you know, were an oral tradition passed down, a lot of them included examples when the Buddha was basically practicing a real care for others. And it's easy to kind of find those examples. So, I mean, there's the classic one of the case of dysentery, where a monk who was basically had dysentery was on the outskirts of a collection of bhikkhus, which is a word for the people who are practicing underneath the Buddha and had gone forth from their life. And this person, you know, the Buddha kind of came upon this person and said, well, why are you out here in such a state? Why isn't someone looking after you? And he said, well, I'm basically not very useful to anybody, so they don't really care about me. And then the Buddha took care of him. And then that was kind of just one of the stories that was passed down in the Buddhist tradition. And the Buddha had, there were other stories along those lines where the Buddha just showed care, kindness, consideration for others. And there was also a classic story of the three Anuruddhas, which were three monks who were practicing together in a forest. And the Buddha came to them and said, well, how's it going? And they basically were practicing in harmony. And the phrase they used was practicing in harmony, you know, like milk blending with water. Yeah? And what they would do is they would just support one another. So someone would come back first from alms rounds, which was the begging rounds, and they would kind of make the place for everybody else that was due to come back. And then, you know, as the meal was eaten, and as there were other chores to be done, people just did what was needed and contributed how it was needed and just did what they had to do to support one another. And it's a very famous example from the Pali Canon of just that community living. Well, obviously, if you can gain enlightenment by being an individual and just going your own way, there wouldn't be so many stories about this communal aspect of Buddhism. So there was a whole movement in Buddhism of bringing out this other side, and it culminated in the teachings of the Bodhisattva ideal. And there's a very famous book by a Buddhist scholar named Shantideva, and it's called the Bodhicaryavatara, yeah? And that's the way of the Bodhisattva. And Shantideva is an interesting one because Shantideva was in a monastery in Nalanda, the story goes, which was a famous monastery in India, and everybody thought he was a slackard, yeah? So they all thought that he would just kind of, because he basically slept all day, something like that. So he slept all day, and they thought, well, he just kind of slacks off. He's not paying attention to learning about Buddhism. He's not doing anything helpful. Let's shame him, basically. And let's shame him so much that he wants to leave. So we're going to publicly shame him. So what they did was they asked him if he'd give a talk in front of everybody. And they thought, well, this will surely do it because he won't know what he's talking about. He'll make a mess of it, and then he'll be so embarrassed he'll leave. But little did they know that all night he studied. You know, he studied and practiced really intensely. And he was actually much more spiritually advanced than any of them. Yeah. So when he did come to speak, which is supposedly the words of this text, which this text is also really, really important in the Tibetan tradition. So you'll hear lots of references to it amongst the Tibetans. So when he came to talk and he gave that speech, they all sort of realized that he was so much more advanced than them. And he basically, in this book, kind of starts to lay out what was probably thinking already happening, but it was thinking about the Bodhisattva ideal. It was thinking about practicing for the sake of others, not just for yourself. And in fact, shifting that whole frame of reference so that your reference is towards others, that your reference is outward looking and altruistic. Yeah? And essentially, it's almost as if you are seeking enlightenment for the sake of all other sentient beings. So you sort of realize that when your mind is clear, when your mind is not polluted with craving and hatred and spiritual ignorance, that you are a benefit and a greater benefit to the situation you're in than when your mind's polluted with those things. So you're practicing not just for yourself, but also because every situation you get in, you want to be as beneficial to that situation for both yourself and others as you possibly can. And it's that aspiration to really constantly be at your best so that the world around you can be at its best. Yeah? Which is the Bodhisattva ideal. Yeah? That's the arising of the Bodhicitta. That's where we're going with the Bodhisattva practice. So, I haven't followed my notes at all, so I'm kind of trying to figure out where I'm at. That's okay. So with respect to this altruism, that kind of that you sort of are connecting in with. You're not losing yourself either when you do that. So when it comes to the different bodhisattvas, and you might have heard the term used in Buddhism, we talk about bodhisattvas. So on the wall back there, there's a picture. It's kind of got like a white, two white half circles on either side. Those are actually arms. And that figure is the bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. And you're moving, when you're talking about those sorts of bodhisattvas, you're moving from a historical bodhisattva, which might be someone like Shantideva, yeah, to an archetypal bodhisattva. So an archetypal bodhisattva is more like an image of an aspect of the enlightened mind, which has become manifest in a symbol. So in this case, with thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, the story is that Avalokiteshvara at one point in time was actually a practitioner like us, you know, but very advanced practitioner. And basically, out of compassion for the world, vowed to never turn back and never have a despairing thought, but to constantly to seek out to ameliorate the sufferings of the world. And that if ever his mind or her mind, because Avalokiteshvara is kind of a moves beyond male and female, in Avalokiteshvara's mind, if that ever kind of came into question, he said, may I scatter into a thousand pieces? May my being just be scattered completely. And, well, of course, after eons and eons and eons of trying to sort out all the suffering in the world, there was a despairing thought and boom, you know, like just went everywhere. It was really kind of not a good sight, yeah. So, but it's an archetypal thing. So it's like through that kind of that process, Avalokiteshvara was also the power of Avalokiteshvara's practice was such that he came back together and manifested with 1,000 arms and 11 heads, such that each of the arms has an eye in the hand, and each of the arms holds something that's useful to beings. And the 11 heads look in all directions. So there's something about what the truth of this is something about compassion, something about the shattering of the ego that has to happen in order to truly be compassionate. That as long as it's you saving the world, you will shatter into 1,000 pieces. Yeah, you can't do it. Yeah, you as an individual ego cannot meet the suffering of the world. You could do it for a while, but you will have despair. And basically, you're going to need to shatter your ego in order to become capable of addressing all the sufferings in the world. So that's one archetypal bodhisattva. There's others. There's Manjushri on the wall there above Vajrajyoti's head, which is the bodhisattva of wisdom. Actually, there's another Manjushri right here. But this red figure, maybe you could say that's a Buddha, which is slightly different from bodhisattva. But are there others? Here's Kuan Yin, which is a Chinese version of Avalokiteshvara, not thousand-armed, but the four-armed. But there's lots of different bodhisattvas. There's green Tara, there's white Tara, which are associated with compassion. There's Padmasambhava, which is associated with more of like virya and skillful action, but also enlightenment itself manifests in the world in a sort of a kind of very potent way. So Padmasambhava brought Buddhism to Tibet and overcame the demons. So there's a whole story of that. There's also bodhisattvas like Vajrapani, and there's a whole host of them. And these figures are very archetypal, so they're not actual historical figures, but they're symbols. And so that can be talked about as bodhisattvas. So I wanted to go into that a little, just so that in case you run across that, you'll know what that sort of bodhisattva is and how that's different from like a person practicing the bodhisattva ideal. But with respect to this bodhisattva ideal, when we practice, we don't become homogenous. So as we each practice, we will manifest, like the bodhisattvas, the archetypal ones, we will become more ourselves. Yep. So one of the comparisons I really love is a light shining through stained glass. So the light is basically the light of sort of awakening, or the light of wisdom, the light of prana. The stained glass is kind of who you are and your habits. So you're probably gonna become, you'll be who you are now. It's hard to talk about to some extent, because you won't kind of you won't become unidentifiable as an individual. You'll actually become more of who you can in a positive sense. So if you've got a lot of energy, your energy, that energy will become very freed up. All of its stickiness around things will just dissipate, and your energy will be something that you can apply all the time and quite freely. You'll become a lot more spontaneous. Yeah. If you've got a good sense of artistic imagination and stuff, chances are, as you kind of deepen your practice, you'll still be artistic. You'll still be able to see aesthetic beauty, but you'll actually, that sense will become more pristine. You know, it's almost as if the stained glass that's you gets cleaned, yeah? And all the corners which kind of had dirt in them, yeah, and all the kind of the, maybe the some of the colors had faded, well, they come back full strength. And not only do they come back full strength, but maybe even they take on a different luster, you know, a more vividness, you know, more color. So you'll probably become, you know, more artistic, more creative, yeah? If you've got an intellectual kind of reasoning kind of sense of things, you really like things to make sense, you're not going to lose that, yeah? You're going to become clearer, yeah? You're going to become clearer and more reasonable, yeah? If you've got a heart that's kind, you'll become kinder, yeah? That's what will happen. Your heart will become purified and you'll become kinder. And in that sort of way, really interestingly, each of us in this room, as we practice something like the Bodhisattva ideal, we shine more and more and more as ourselves. And in shining like that, funny enough, we also can see within one another that light shining through. That's a really odd thing, but it's really beautiful because you get that feeling of the freedom, you know, the ability to make choices, the openness, you know, the sensitivity to beauty. You get that as something that other people like you are coming into tune with. Yeah, and you can taste it. You can taste that in other people. It is a fact. And as you taste it, you'll see that who they are is exactly who they would have been and exactly who they should be. And there's a great story from the Pali Canon about the Buddha with this, which some of you have heard a couple times probably, and you probably get bored with it, but I really love it because what's happening is the monks in an evening, one of the monks named Ananda, who was the assistant to the Buddha in latter years, kind of decided he'd go visit this other monk named Sariputra. And Sariputra is just in a forest nearby, and he's just kind of just visiting him. Kind of, it's a bit like, hey, look, do you kind of want to go over and visit Sariputra, and we'll just chat, hang out in the forest. And so the other monks kind of go with him, and they all end up at this forest. And Sariputra, being monks, they kind of talk really kind of, I don't know, I guess they talk about the Dharma, yeah? So they get to the forest, and Sariputra says, well, you know, what I'd really love to hear you guys say is to tell me what sort of monk, what sort of bhikkhu would really kind of like illuminate this salt forest that we're in? You know, it's like, what sort of practitioner would beautify the forest? And so each of the monks kind of goes through and says, you know, kind of what sort of practitioner they think would be most beautiful in that forest. And they all describe themselves. Yeah? They all describe themselves. So Ananda talks about someone with really good memory that remembers what's told to him, which is what he did with the Buddha. He remembered everything the Buddha said. He was also very kind, and he mentions that. Someone else who's a really good meditator and can put their mind wherever they want it to sit talks about that. Someone else who is like very devoted to practices of renunciation says, well, you know, it's the renunciant that would be perfect. And they all describe themselves, and then they take what they've said to the Buddha, and that's quite common practice. It sort of like lends a stamp of approval to it, So you go to the Buddha and you repeat what's been said, and then you say, oh, does that make sense to you? Or you agree? And in this case, the Buddha said, yeah, of course. It's just exactly what each of you should have said. You know? And I just think that's a lovely sutta. You know, I think it's really lovely because I think that it really, in me, it reinforced in me the idea that I would not become like all of you, which nothing personal, yeah. But I want to pursue my own ideal in a way, yeah. And also the other thing is that it reinforced in me that you're not going to become like me, because that would be a real pain in the ass. Because, you know, don't want more of me around now. No. So. And also, I think the interesting thing is that with the bodhicitta, you know, with this kind of will to enlightenment that can kind of rise up, our teacher, Sangharaksha, also says that it's not something that you own yourself. It's not something that is yours, yeah? But it's something that rises up in a community, yeah? It's something that rises up when people practice together. So in a way, what this center is attempting to be is a place where the bodhicitta can arise amongst all of us. Yeah? But the thing is that I can't get the bodhicitta to arise independent of you. So it does arise in a community. What happens is the community gets that sense of sort of, I don't know, it's like you've got to have other people around you in order to really experience this fully. You know, in order for kindness to be flowing, there have to be people practicing kindness. In order for there to be generosity that's alive and active, there have to be people being generous with one another. That's the way it works. And something really magical can happen. And you can feel it, you know it when it's happening. And I know you'll know when you're with your mates and things are really harmonious and there's a lot of kindness and clarity between you, you know that feeling. You know that feeling, you know it. Well, what the Buddha was telling us and what the teachings are telling us is that feeling, the depth of it, yeah, we're a bit like Alice in Alice in Wonderland, yeah? The rabbit hole goes really deep, okay? So be ready, you know, because it's deeper than we could ever imagine, yeah? But in a very positive way. It was the thing I hated about The Matrix was, you know, in the Matrix, you kind of wake up to a reality which basically sucks, yeah? You wake up to a reality where everyone wears gray and you eat this breakfast cereal that comes out of these test tubes, which is like ultra-technological protein. You know, but the guy that wants out of it, that throws them all in and cheats, basically, he cheats because he likes the taste of steak. Yeah? Because he's saying, like, look, I don't want to live a drab existence like this. And the fact is that the reason I don't like The Matrix is because I think that when we practice, reality isn't drab. It's quite the opposite. Reality is magnificently beautiful. Yeah? Where we're at right now is drab. Yeah? We don't think that's the case, but when we start meditating and when we start practicing, we realize that it is the case. So you'll know that if you start meditating, because as you meditate, one of the things a beginning meditator, sort of almost everybody begins meditation experiences, if you practice regularly, is colors become brighter, yeah? Things become more alive. You start to notice things around you didn't notice before, yeah? You start to notice people you didn't notice before. The world becomes more interesting, a bit like being on a mushroom trip, but better, because you don't have to pay for the mushrooms. And it's also a lot broader and a lot more kind of just amazing, to be honest. Yeah, and it just keeps going in that way. If you can keep practicing and you can let go of this rigid petty sense of self that we've all got, that's kind of me. You know, you actually experience a lot of joy. Yeah, it's very joyful to be rid of that kind of voice. Yeah, that sort of perspective and that narrative. So, so with respect to the Bodhisattva, when it comes to the Mahayana and the Mahayana teachings, they are teachings of abundance. And there are a couple sort of dualities that I thought I'd talk about a little bit just with respect to the Bodhisattva ideal. So one is that, and these are just things I've heard recently from people, and this one is a duality between abundance and scarcity. Yeah? We live in a world in which things are seen as being scarce. Yeah, things are seen as being limited. Yep. And in that world, it's sort of like what you want to do is you want to get things for yourself. It's a bit like a win-lose situation. If you get something, then someone else doesn't have it. That's kind of the economic model that we work under. And most people, to some extent, feel like they don't have enough, or they've got to guard what they've got, and be wary and be kind of, you know, spend a lot of time shepherding stuff. And I'm not discounting being responsible with your possessions, because obviously that's a good thing, yeah? And I'm not discounting the value of money and the value of a nice house and the value of an iPad and the value of nice clothing and food and all that. I mean, all that's beautiful. But it's almost like a scarcity mentality, yeah, that we can have. And the Bodhisattva's got an abundance mentality. The Bodhisattva, when we go into the Mahayana scriptures, the Bodhisattva in the Mahayana scriptures talk about the world being jeweled. Yeah? As if the world is jeweled, as if you walk out in the world and as if there's like jewel trees and jeweled lawns and jeweled cars. And obviously, I really don't think that they're walking out. You know, we don't take it literally, do we? But the fact is that all that jewels represent is something that's precious. Yeah? So you start seeing the world as precious. You start seeing things as precious. And you can. This is what happens when you practice spiritually. You start having more of a sense of the preciousness of the things around you. And when you start acting in that way, or not acting really, but when you let go of this scarcity mentality and that whole kind of feeling of constant lack in a way, you start to realize how much you actually have, and you start to live in an abundance. And that's really joyful. And I was thinking of some of the ways in which we're abundant. And I kind of, you know, think I live very richly in a certain way. I mean, I don't make much money. I'm supported by the center. There's other people like me too in the Sangha. But my God, you know, 200 years ago, someone that lived like I live, you know, that could travel around the world and see foreign countries, that had, you know, the clothing I have, the computers I have, you know, kings didn't have that wealth 200 years ago. You know, 100 years ago, I'm, you know, if I put myself back 100 years ago, I would, you know, I would be in the upper 5% of the population with my access to fresh food and all sorts of stuff, medicine, hospital care, education, information. I mean, it's just phenomenal how much we've got. Yeah, it really, really is. But somehow we always judge ourselves not on an absolute basis as to, you know, how rich we are, but we judge ourselves in comparison to everybody else. And that is just like, you'll always be short of somebody. You know, there'll always be someone who has more money than you, is smarter than you, is better looking than you, is taller than you, is shorter than you. You know, there'll always be somebody like that. But with the Bodhisattva, I don't think they don't really act in that sort of way. I think with a Bodhisattva, they're they're sort of seeing qualities around them as they're not seeing them as mine or yours. They're sort of seeing qualities as being just adornments, just jewels in the world. And so they probably, a Bodhisattva would probably take as much joy seeing an act of kindness as if they'd done it themselves, you know, because there'd just be this desire for that beauty to manifest. The other kind of duality I thought was interesting was seriousness. Anthony brought this up the other day in our men's study. He said, "You guys were always so serious, it seems like, at the center. Everybody's so serious." And well, the Bodhisattva isn't serious. The Bodhisattva is playful. So the Bodhisattva is seen to be like an elephant on a hot summer's day who dives into a pool of lotuses and just splashes water all over the place. Yeah? And then gets out of that pool and jumps into another one. Yeah? And the Bodhisattvas were always playing. There's a really good sutta called the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. And in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, the main Bodhisattva, that, you know, and this is a human being in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, just plays. The whole sutta just plays with people, plays with the situation, you know, to the point of, you know, just kind of like, it's just a constant play. So, you know, everybody's in the room, and so he creates these, you know, he creates food to eat, and he creates seats to sit in, but the seats are really tall, so everybody's like, well, how are we going to get up into that one, you know? But the thing about playfulness versus seriousness is that what seriousness, you know, and once again, I don't want to cut down being serious about things, because I think seriousness is very important too. Yeah, so you do need to take things serious from time to time. I'm trying to be serious, but I'm not pulling off a joke, so either way, happens sometimes. But with seriousness, when it goes bad, why it goes bad is because you get rigid. Yeah, you get very rigid. So you're serious, and you're serious about, like, the fact that the Doritos need to have the end folded down and clipped so that they don't go stale. Yeah? That's bad seriousness. Yeah? But we kind of, you know, and we get serious about all sorts of things like that. We get serious about things that have to be a certain way in order for happiness and lack of train wrecks. But the Bodhisattva doesn't have that same sense. So the Bodhisattvas might think, well, yeah, it's better if the Doritos are kind of folded up. But hey, you know, they're Doritos. Let's just eat them all. You know? So there's a playfulness with the Bodhisattva. And I think that playfulness comes out of a sense of openness, comes out of a sense that there is nothing fixed. You know, it comes out of a sense that even they themselves are kind of changing, and everybody's changing, and it's a care. There's a care in the moment, but that care is also fully aware of the open dimension of being. You know, fully aware of that open dimension of being. And you all would know that open dimension of being, because you've probably all had a moment where you have opened out to it more. You know, you probably all have a moment where your mind just was very playful, and you know the joy of that. You know kind of what it feels like when your heart is light and not rigid and tight around things. And so the Bodhisattva is coming from that playfulness. The other thing, which I've already talked about, that I had down here was aloneness versus togetherness. Because I think the Bodhisattva is also, the Bodhisattva ideal is about kind of meeting people in their lives where they're at. And it's about being in the world. So the Bodhisattva is not kind of leaving the world behind. The Bodhisattva is about helping the world to make these transformations, you know, transformations which benefit everybody. So there is a togetherness in it, you know, which which is very vivid. So the archetypal images that I was talking about earlier, those bodhisattvas are seen to be, kind of like powers in the world. You know, they're seen to be kind of, it's not so much that they're like superheroes that kind of come and bring compassion and stuff, but they are forces. They're forces of compassion, forces of good and kindness and stuff like that. And so they're just, I guess they're alive, and they're alive in amongst people. You know, they need people in order to manifest. Without people, they don't come into, you know, they kind of drop away. That's how gods work, in a way. You know, it's our imagination that kind of brings them alive. They don't exist independent. They're not literally existent. They exist relative to us. There's a great book, I forget what, Gaiman, Gaiman, something like that. Is he an author, science fiction kind of? Yeah, and he wrote some book about this with these gods that basically trade off of people believing in them. And when people stop believing in them, they lose their power. And it was this gambit by a few gods to gain power again. I kind of got bored with it, to be honest. But interesting concept. So what we're going to be talking about over the next 6 weeks, and I attempted to do, this was very informal sort of presentation, and you won't find this technically written up in any Buddhist book. Yeah, but hopefully I was trying to give you a bit of the spirit of the bodhisattva ideal, a bit of the spirit of what it might be like to be a bodhisattva, some thoughts that I had myself on it. But over the next 4 weeks or so, we're going to be exploring different facets of how the bodhisattva would practice. So over the next 3 weeks, we're going to be looking at the six perfections. And the six perfections are six things that a bodhisattva would practice. So you've got three pairs. You've got, and that's not pairs, P-E-A-R. It's, you know, like pairs, P-A-I-R. You got six pairs. And the first pair is sila, which is ethics, or skillfulness, and dana, which is generosity. The next one is going to be kshanti, which is patience, and virya, which is energy. And the last one is pranya, which is wisdom, and dhyana, which is concentration. So three people will talk about those pairs and how they practice in their life, and what those words might mean, and what they might mean in the tradition, the Buddhist tradition. But that's how the bodhisattva, that's technically what a bodhisattva would practice, is those six perfections. Yeah. So it's a little different model than what you might get if you looked at the Pali Canon. The Pali Canon has just a different frame for how you practice. But you know, they're kind of like different facets of the same jewel. The jewel being enlightenment, and it can be approached from different ways. And this is a really prominent way of practice, which, like I said, has had a heavy influence on Tibetan Buddhism, and also has a very kind of extensive following all through Asia, but also through India and stuff. The distinction between, like, the Mahayana and the other forms of Buddhism, it's more... It seems like it's maybe they're different things, but as you start to practice and as you explore the practices, you realize it's all the same thing, and you can see the connections just looking at it from different angles. So we'll be doing that for a couple of weeks, and then we'll have another talk on the bodhicitta, which is the will to enlightenment, which is that kind of that welling up of something that happens in a bodhisattva. It's the equivalent of stream entry, if you're familiar with that, within like Pali Canon Buddhism. And so it's that point of irreversibility where your heart or your mind or your will changes, and it kind of changes the gravitational pull of the world. You kind of manage to pull away from that and are instead in the gravitational pull of awakening. So you're definitely going to awakening, and you will definitely get there. And it's that turning point. It's that cusp point, that saddle point, where things kind of, you know, the watershed where it splits. So if you get beyond that point, if the bodhicitta does arise, then in a way you're in the flow, you're in the current. So, I was going to finish with some verses from the Bodhicharavatara. And these are verses that we sometimes use in the puja, which is a ritual practice we do. And I just think they're interesting. I like these particular verses. So I won't kind of comment on them afterwards. I'll just read them, and then maybe we'll just have a bit of silence, then some questions and answers, if there's anything, any comments or anything anybody wants to add. So this is at the end of a chapter. There's a whole bunch of chapters on the perfections and just the arising of bodhicitta and stuff like that. But at this point, he's almost like Shantideva's getting to a point where he's sort of declaring himself for having moved on to the bodhisattva path and manifested the bodhisattva ideal, and he's rejoicing, really. So it goes, "Today my birth is fruitful. My human life is justified. Today I am born into the family of the Buddha. Now I am the Buddha's son. So that there may be no blemish upon this spotless family, I must now act as becomes my family. As a blind man might find a jewel in heaps of rubbish, so too this awakening mind has somehow appeared in me. It is the elixir of life, born to end death in the world. It is the inexhaustible treasure, alleviating poverty in the world. This is the supreme medicine, curing the sickness of the world, a tree of shelter for the weary creatures staggering along the road of existence, the causeway to cross over bad rebirths, open to all who travel. It is the rising moon of the mind, mitigating the defilements of the world. It is the brilliant sun, dispelling the mist of ignorance from the world. It is the fresh butter risen up from churning the milk of the true Dharma. For the caravan of humanity, traveling the road of existence, hungry for the enjoyment of happiness, this is a feast of happiness, offered as refreshment to all beings who approach. Today, I summon the world to Buddhahood, into worldly happiness meanwhile. In the presence of all, may God's Titans and all rejoice."